And that transformation is underway globally, and it's not going to be held up. It may be, I don't know if you could even measure it. And I think the rest of the world will rally and move forward with decarbonization, with the exception of a few fossil states, which the US has actually sadly always kind of been part of anyway, as a huge not only fossil producer, but fossil consumer. So it's not that new of a constellation. I do worry about the world kind of breaking down into a fossil block versus a renewable block, sort of the old Cold War, but along the lines of energy. And, in a situation like that, potential conflicts over the thawing Arctic region and even Antarctica for resources, if it really starts becoming more accessible. That's still pretty far-fetched right now, but it's being eyed, also for marine resources. There are concerns about Chinese krill harvest in around Antarctica. And so, yeah, I mean, climate politics have always been part of global geopolitics, I think.
Well, I highly recommend our listeners continue to follow your work on Inside Climate News. Bob Berwin, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
You're welcome, Alex. Always a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Wayne Shorter, Neil Young, and Ricky Lee Jones. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Greetings, I'm Ansa Craiglin.
And I'm Winston Watson.
And I'm Donna Clark.
And we are The Meditation.
We are listening to Community Radio.
KBOO
90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. Dig it.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Have him on my wall. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are artist Alex Kujana and curator of Indigenous art at the Halliford Museum of Art, Rebecca Dobkins. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Alex.
Thank you. I appreciate what you're doing here.
So, Alex, there's this biennial. It's the Crow's Shadow Institute of the Arts Biennial, and it's on now in Salem through June the 20th, 2026. And it's a selection of great prints from Crow's Shadow, the Umatilla Reservation print studio in the gorge. And you were selected, and you were actually an artist in residence for 2 weeks. So you went in there blind, and they said, just do whatever you want. So what did you do?
I created a series of food that's geometric in design and added a whole bunch of colors and a lot of meaning that's primarily painted around my language and my love of food and my battle with food. My exposure to urban life as well as reservation life, and just a lot of fun use of color symbolism that shows up at really meaningful for moments at Crow's Shadow Institute of the Arts. Since I grew up in the area and have been going there since a young kid, I had the chance to be invited after practicing art in my community and being recognized for that for well over a decade, probably, and that basically earned me an invite for 2 weeks.
The three pieces you have in this upper room, the print kind of area of the Halliford Museum in Salem, they're three vertical rectangles each has a diagonal composition, a sort of white space below, and then a roughly shaded painting in the background of filling in, kind of, but with designs cut out of it, like semicircles and maybe stars on the black one. And then in the middle of each one, in the slash across the middle, is sushi, so a tray of four pieces, four rolls, and then there's one's a taco, very geometrical, you know, it kind of looks like the cardboard holder for a taco because the sides are kind of angled. And then pizza, it's again like a very triangular slice. And each one is kind of dripping with bright colors. So just tell us, what type of print is this? And what was the, did you create a painting and then they turned it into a print? Just explain how these came to be.
Well, these are called monoprints, and basically it's a very old school way to make a print. I got to basically use all kinds of different colors and chemicals. It's a whole insane chemical scientific process just to be able to transfer their special kind of ink on the paper, mm-hmm. and also to be able to work with it to make it do what you want it to do. You have to use like alcohol or oils, you know, to change it up for what you want to do with it.
So with a monoprint, you kind of paint on plastic and then run it through a press, and that squeezes the paint onto the paper. Is that right?
Well, the process essentially, what I did for my pieces is I started off with a special pencil that is captured by light to transfer to a metal sheet that makes like the base part of what you'll see in all of the pieces here. You'll see kind of like a pencil drawing of the geometric food items in the center and kind of taking over and repeating itself in the prints. The only thing that changes are the colors. So the first process was to get the pencil onto the paper. And then after that, the ink, I guess you could call it, gets transferred onto all of the papers blank with no color, just the outline of where it says pizza there or sushi there or taco there. You'll see, you know, the lettering and then the lines that form the shape of the food, but there's no color. And those are the first sheets that come out, is doing a chemical process with, I don't even remember all the chemicals that Maggie Middleton used. I just remember seeing her kind of whip everything up. And that's the important part that I remember feeling like I would never be able to do this without the master printer, the printer assistant, like everybody involved made these possible. So it's a whole huge process. I really don't have it down. I didn't get a degree in it. I just grew up on the reservation. I had the chance to go in, and they helped me every step of the way to be able to accomplish what my goals were.
So you described what you do as graphic arts on an iPad, very geometrical. You also make music, you take photos, you're well traveled. So coming in to make this food series, you had a kind of revelation, didn't know what you were gonna do, woke up thinking about geometric food and like, that's it, I'm gonna do it.
Not just geometric food. I woke up having a feeling of wanting to hear my ancestors say these foods without having any influence by Westernization, colonization, any of that. Just a language and an accent that's like untouched by any of that. Just, I wish I could go back in time, kind of like through space and time, and just hear what it sounds like to tell them what kind of food we're eating now and say, this is what we're eating now, and them say it, you know, like the English version with their accents, or, you know, just to reach through to them somehow. I wish I could, you know what it was like. And as an ICWA baby, you know, Indian Child Welfare Act, as I spoke about, it was having, you know, connection to my community, my culture was really important to me. And I think that reflects in these pieces when I try to fight to grab onto my language and learn everything I can, including diacritics taught to our people by a Japanese man. His last name is Aoki. I believe his first name is Harao. I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's like Harao. Anyway, his last name's Aoki. He helped us create a language to basically learn our own language. He created a written system for us.
Yeah. So these three pieces, you use like the triangles and dots of the play, pause, fast forward, symbols from audio, you use X's. You have these tall rectangles which represent the tall buildings of Portland where you were born. And then you moved to Warm Springs and were raised by your uncle. But you also name the food. So pizza is P-I-I-C-A with a diacritical accent on the first I. Taco, you know, T-A-A-Q-O. Sushi, S-U-U-S-I-I. So you're trying to communicate that. Well, I don't know how to phrase this. I think you're trying to translate modern food into something else, into a different language.
I'm essentially showing what I learned in my language due to the help of a random Japanese linguist. I wouldn't have even learned any of this stuff if it wasn't for him. That's why I chose sushi, because he's from Japan and I wanted to do something to honor him. So I chose that food item. I also love sushi. And so I wanted to show the diacritics that were given to us, basically to show this is how we are still holding on to our culture, our language. Mm-hmm. It's not always from within our community. Sometimes it's outsiders who come in and help us grab onto mm-hmm. what belongs to us. And so yeah, I really just wanted to show the small little, I guess, tiny little mark on there is a huge story. There's a huge story behind those tiny little diacritics.
So in your talk, you said, you know, you grew up with like PBJs and mm-hmm. whatever your uncle would make you, and he was not a good chef. And then you ate a lot of junk food and you got really fat. And then you discovered HelloFresh, right?
Well, I started learning how to cook fresh food because of HelloFresh. I didn't know how to get everything hot and ready at the same time. I didn't have exposure on how good you can make fresh food. Mm-hmm. Experiencing being unhoused because of a house fire definitely made it so all I was eating was junk food.
Oh, you were living in your car eating McDonald's every day.
Yeah, it was tough. For 8 months, I was kind of just putting on weight and just getting by. I was working 3 jobs, sleeping in my car. I finally got into a place and changed, you know, everything around. But it took many years to put off all the weight that I put on, you know, because you can't just lose it overnight. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can if it's unhealthy, but I was trying to be healthy and balanced.
Where do you live now?
I'm on the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I've moved around a lot and I traveled a lot, but I always end up back home on the res. So I really like it there. I like my language, culture.
So Crow's Shadow started with James Lavador, and they were open. When you were a kid, there was nothing to do. You said the internet was super slow in 2000, so you weren't stuck on the internet all day. But you go down to Crow's Shadow and see what they were doing. They'd have like open days, and there's a picture of you making something in a background while Tim Rollins in 2000 is sort of leading some kind of workshop. Did you know when you were 13 that art would be a big part of your life, you know, in your 20s and 30s?
No, not at all. Actually, I started playing guitar at 14, and then I was like obsessed with it, started playing constantly. My first instrument was piano. I learned how to play by ear and started composing before my feet could touch the ground. I was writing music. So I was actually very fully committed to my music career. I've traveled
Rock and roll?
I do contemporary folk, I guess, is sort of the best way to categorize it. But
so it was music, and then where did art come from?
Art's sort of always been there in my life in the background. So I was like, for example, in high school leadership class, you know, I was sort of the go-to guy for making all the flyers and stuff for the assemblies, or, you know, they're like, oh, Alex is signs. He knows how to make a good sign, you know. I just kind of understood contrast and color and, mm-hmm. you know, kind of at a young age, and just practicing all the time. It was just a natural instinct, and I just mm-hmm. have always practiced in some way, shape, or form.
So you have a day job right now, right?
Right. I work surveillance through my tribe at the casino.
What, like watching people count cards, that kind of surveillance? Or just making sure they don't, like, steal food?
All of the above. Yeah, if you can imagine it, you know, just keeping everybody safe and mm-hmm. just practicing surveying the area and recording, and that's about it, you know. Mm-hmm.
As a young native artist, I mean, you're always going to get pigeonholed, and for better or worse, what do you think of the options open to a native artist? Because a certain type of art that gift shop people love, but there's the whole rest of the world. Do you feel there's a lot of opening for you to express yourself?
I do feel slightly limited personally, especially right now, living as a trans person. I was born female. I identify as male now and started transitioning a long time ago. And I don't really feel there's a lot of opportunities once people either find out about me or word gets on the street. I guess I quote unquote pass, but a lot of folks still have an issue with that. And mm-hmm. I've been roadblocked for that. I've actually been told that before. Mm-hmm. So it's tough, but you know, that just means they're not right for me. And I welcome all of the rejection. I just consider it a redirection to the right people for me. Mm-hmm. And that's what's been happening. I mean, all the places I've been rejected and all of the places I'm not accepted at, there's always somebody else who it does show up and somebody else who does connect with me or want to, you know, lift me up or give me a shot. Mm-hmm. And that's people like Rebecca, people like Crow Shadow. Rebecca Dobkins, she's the curator for this whole thing going on here. And, you know, she also helped put together a book for Crow Shadow. And I didn't even connect the two dots when she invited me to come to this. I didn't even know. I was like, I recognize her name, but it took me a minute. And I was like, I have the book. It's the 20, after 25 years, they did a special Crow Shadow book. And I actually ended up in it. So that they just have a picture of me in there. And it just came to me. I'm like, I'm living in my dream. I've always really enjoyed James Lavador's work, what he's doing, who he is, you know, we became friends over the years, and he's always encouraged me. And, you know, to be able to share a space of art that, you know, essentially he helped me, encourage me to do in the same space with him is a dream come true. This has been a dream of mine for a long time, just to be featured and you know, sharing a space with an artist who's been inspiring me most of my life.
Does a show like this and a residency like that get you anywhere? Like, is it open any doors? Like, do you have something big coming up that you're planning will happen?
Well, I definitely have a lot more people reaching out to me to keep me busy. So I'm doing mural work right now. A lot of people are throwing me on the side of a building and telling me to just put whatever I want. And this is in Pendleton right now.
Okay.
So I'm finally getting a lot more options for, you know, now that people are seeing that I'm really serious about this and organizing myself logistically to get mm-hmm. it done. I'm not always focused because I have ADHD, but I, you know, this is one thing I can really get down and mm-hmm. and show up for, make myself, you know, work extra hard to get done because I love mural work. So all those doors have been opening for me. People kind of just like, oh, you know, we really want something in here. And, you know, the tribe had a really drab looking room for supervised visits for the Department of Child and Family Services. It was just really like you don't want to be in there, you know? So they asked me to warm it up. And so we came up with a plan and I painted all four walls. And I mean, they said it was a massive improvement for all of the kids and families going through there. I mean, that's full circle for me. I mean, I get to do something meaningful for kids just kind of floating around, which is what I was, you know, mm-hmm. an equa baby. Kind of like I was always kind of in and out of places like that, going through stuff. And then, you know, getting to make a space that's like warm and inviting and shows these kids like you mean something and you belong, and I'm going to start crying. So that's the kind of work I really like to do, is something that means something to culture, you know, to people, like connecting with each other and healing and mm-hmm. and coming together through the odds. You know, that's kind of the kind of work I like to do. And luckily, those are the kind of people reaching out to me now. So really love the connections Crow Shadow, specifically Crow Shadow, has given me. Yeah.
Alex is available on TikTok at WUNSKEEE. That's Wunski with three E's. And his website is alxkujana.com. Thanks very much for doing our focus, Alex.
Thank you. Cut to you out, y'all.
What does that mean?
Thank you.
Oh, okay. My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are artist Alex Kujana and curator of Indigenous art at the Hallie Ford Museum of Art, Rebecca Dobkins. Thanks for doing Art Focus, Rebecca.
Thank you for having us.
So in this half of the show, we're talking to Rebecca, who worked with Crow's Shadow and helped put together their biennial, which is on now through June 20th, 2026. And that gives us a look at what's going on at the print studio in Umatilla in Eastern Oregon and the amazing work they do there. So, Rebecca, just tell us briefly how the two institutions connected, Hallie Ford in Salem and Crow's Shadow in the Gorge?
The Crow's Shadow Institute of the Arts was founded in 1992, and the Halle Ford Museum of Art opened its doors in 1998. And we began collaborating in the early 2000s. I and others at the Halle Ford were really interested in what was going on at Crow's Shadow, the beginnings of the print studio there, or the continuation of the print studio with the hiring of a master printer, Frank Jansen, in the early 2000s, and of course working with James Lavador, the renowned Eastern Oregon painter. So in the early 2000s, our collaboration took two forms. One was to create archives at the Halle Ford, where we keep one of every edition. Those are online. We documented them with the help of Crow Shadow. And then the other thing we do is the biennials, so that every 2 years we host a biennial exhibition at the museum where we showcase the work of the prior 2 years of artist in residency at Crow Shadow.
So we talked to Alex Kujana earlier, who did a 2 week stint at Crow Shadow. Some of the other works you can find in the print study room as you go upstairs as a room. It feels like a library, you know, it has tables and glass cases. There's a very dramatic James Lavador print on the wall called Winter 2023. And it's this amazing kind of triangular mountain with stripes, horizontal stripes. It's red and yellow streaks vertically, so like lava colors. And then the background is dark, dark purple. It's very simple. It's not like painting, you know, in the sense that there's a limit to the blending of colors, you know. And then also the shape of the image is slightly cartoony. It could be like a bunch of pavers stacked up. That's how sort of thick the horizontal bars are of this mountain. Obviously, James Lavador is known for his landscapes, his semi-abstract work. What do you think making prints does for Lavador's work, which was obviously rooted in painting?
Well, you're right to draw attention to this amazing lithograph, Winter 2023. It really leaps off the wall, and the colors are extraordinary. In talking with James Lavador over now many years about the relationship between printmaking and painting for him, is he talks about them as being really complementary. And part of his commitment to Crow Shadow as a print studio, among all the other things it does, because it also supports customary arts, was the power of printmaking for visual artists in general, of helping them refine their other practice. So, mm-hmm. As you mentioned, Lavador is known as a painter working with abstracted landscapes and other sort of what I would call terrestrial forms and properties of paint, as Jim calls it. And that involves a lot of layering, but some of this layering and scraping and multiple runs that have to happen in printmaking informed his painting many years ago, 30 years ago, when he began printmaking. Like this, for example, is a five-color lithograph, so it would have been run through the press five times to get those different colors laid down. And seeing and experiencing this process with the master printer was part of what Lavador then brought back to his painting practice, to affirm this sort of many times that he goes back into a painting to lay down new color or to scrape away as he goes.
Yeah. Across the room on one wall, Marwin Begay has a piece called Spirit of the Horse. It's like it's a bird series. In this one, there's a bird perched. Its head is turned 90 degrees, so you see the beak in profile and one eye. Has a light colored chest. It's standing on like a gatepost or something. But it's kind of overlaid with all these wild patterns, geometric patterns that look, they're stars. And then there are sort of hand-drawn four-pointed stars. And then there are big swirls, you know, hand-drawn curves. And then there's this red and blue and orange covering the top half of the bird. The bottom half is pretty pale. So Marvin, why did he do a bird series? And then, of course, where's the horse in this?
This is entitled Spirit of the Horse because Bluebird, who is pictured here, is the creature, the being responsible for convincing the deities that the Navajo people were ready for the responsibility of having horses. So this is showing, in a sense, the moment where the spirit of the horse comes into being for the Navajo people. And the spirit of the horse here is represented by the swirls, the different the dancing blue lines are the spirit of the horse being formed.
And then what are these little hand-drawn four-pointed stars?
In many, many different indigenous iconographies, the four-pointed star can symbolize the four directions. It can symbolize a sacred moment. It can symbolize both the future and the past. Is that he's representing also ancestral knowledge that involves bluebird and horse and the coming of the horse. And then that you'll see the fabric, printed fabric or wallpaper, there's a very similar design there. Mm-hmm. And Marwin also talks about looking for hoof shapes in this image, both in terms of the top. If you look closely, you can see some hoof shapes or things that suggest hoofs. Again, honoring the horse and the horse's presence for the Navajo people.
So that some of these stars are taken from a kind of print, like a wallpaper, yes. Or I think you said maybe an apron or something. Yes. Things you found around, you know, around the house. They're domestic.
Absolutely. So sort of signifying this interrelationship between the people, the story, the connection to the land, the connection to the top part is signaling. The cloud forms are signaling water and rain and nourishment of the land. In this image, every line is very intentional, and it's suggesting this connection between the land, the water, the elements, the people, the ancestral stories, and the horse itself, which makes so much possible for Navajo people, and which is a responsibility.
In one of the glass cases, there is a piece by Kyla Farrell Smith, and this print is—it's called Emergent Glyphology. So it takes petroglyph style. You know, there's a goat with long curled horns. There's a tree that looks like a sort of kid's version of a Christmas tree. You know, just stick, almost like a fish skeleton. So she takes these very basic kind of images and then puts them in a kind of a landscape. There's a dark sky above and what looks like peaked mountains. And then on the foreground, there's another dark gray base. Another goat seems to be on that level. And in the background, there's a snow-capped mountain, which almost could be like a photo of Mount Hood. It's a beautiful piece. The dominant color is gray and a very, very pale blue, but there's a lot of yellow accenting of the lines. What's Kyla's main medium? Is she a painter?
She is a painter and what I would call a mixed media artist too. She works in paint, but she often incorporates literally elements from the land, dirt and other minerals in her painting practice. This print, along with another, is a result of her second residency at Crow Shadow, where she, like the other two artists, worked with then master printer Judith Bauman to create this work. And it's part of a broader series that Kyla has referred to as portal glyphs, meaning that she is interested in the possibilities of worldview, of visions, of alternative realities that are based in ancestral memory and how that memory is represented in the earth and also is activated in a sense by her and her people's encounter with their lands and their homelands. And she, Kyla, is very committed to protecting the homelands of the Klamath Modoc people and other indigenous people. She's been at the forefront of speaking out and being concerned about the mining of rare minerals in her homelands. This work is among those that are referring to the importance of being aware of both the past but also the future and cautioning against violent extraction of minerals on the land that might leave permanent harm to the land.
There's another room, the study gallery, and that has some really vivid Wendy Red Star prints. She looked at the way people decorate those sort of luggage boxes that people put on horses. They all have their own unique design. She made prints based on those. And there's another great image of just a hand with gold nails.
That marvelous work is by Natalie Ball, who is also Klamath and Modoc, like Kyla Farrell Smith. Mm-hmm. And that piece is referred to as Dear Woman's First Tribal Council Email. It's a really marvelous print. Natalie is on Tribal Council, and she's referring, Dear Woman is referring to a figure who is legendary in many, many tribal groups, a sort of trickster, but the image has superimposed on it the words land back. And so this title of Dear Woman's First Tribal Council Email is suggesting the first commitment is to land back to.
Well, there's a lot to see there, so I hope people go down to Salem and check out the Hallie Ford Museum. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week were Alex Kujana, artist, and Rebecca Dobkins, the curator of Indigenous Art at the Hallie Ford Museum of Art. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Rebecca.
Thank you, Joseph, and thank you for shining a light on Crow Shadow Institute of the Arts.
Oh, yeah, I love that place.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Hand him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver stream. Can't tell them apart at all. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
El apoyo a KBOO proviene de los miembros de KBOO y de Muertos PDX, presentando la celebración del Día de Muertos desde el sábado 1 de noviembre hasta el domingo 2 a partir del mediodía. El evento cuenta con música en vivo, vendedores,